Off the ball with BetDak.com, the sports betting exchange. Serious about sport 24/7. Every season, every sport, every team.
All right, you're very welcome along to our Saturday panel this afternoon. With us is the Kildare manager, Kieran O'Neill, and also journalists Kieran Shannon and Christy O'Connor, although you're not really here as journalists today, lads, because we want to talk about backroom teams in particular. Just this whole kind of idea of why people get involved in backroom teams, how it comes about, and what the role of a backroom team is. Kieran, you've worked with Mayo, you've worked with Kerry, and then ultimately you've got the top job at Kildare. When did you start out working in backroom teams?
God, I'd say it was back in the early noughties. I got a bad sports injury quite early in my own playing career, and I couldn't play anymore. But as a PE teacher then by trade and kind of sports scientist, for me it was very natural just to stay involved.
Yeah.
And the only way I could see how I could stay involved when I couldn't play was to get involved with teams. So my first job actually was a great job. It was where Kieran is living now, down in West Clare. It was an intermediate team called Kilmichael, and they gave me an opportunity. I was 23, 24 maybe.
As a coach or as a manager?
As a coach,
right.
Yeah, and you know, never look back. It was kind of the typical club scenario where a coach comes in, but it's club men,
yeah,
you know, that were involved in the management, and they were great guys down there.
How did they hear about the fact that you were 23 and interested in this kind of stuff?
Do you know what? It's a very small community, kind of the PE sports science community in Ireland. Only in recent years, with UCC having a program now, it was traditionally UL for many years and then DCU. So, you know, back then, people would have looked to see who was a PE teacher in a school, who was working in a university in that area. And even if they didn't have a CV behind them, they would have just went with it because they wouldn't have known any better themselves.
And were you living down around that area, or was this a journey for you?
Yeah, well, I was in Limerick at the time. I guess Kilmichael would have been about an hour, you know, so for someone like me at that age, driving it was a 93 Opel Corsa at the time. It was it was an interesting time, but learned a lot in my first year. And Mickey Ned came in soon after, who's a PE teacher by trade himself, to Limerick, and that's when I got the break, if you like, into the inter-county scene.
Okay, so you started to work with Mickey Ned.
Yeah,
right. And how was that?
Yeah, it was great. It was fantastic. It was interesting in a sense because I'd played a little bit of football in Limerick with Mona Lean after my surgery to see if I could get back, and the back just wouldn't let it happen. So I would have known quite a lot of the players, would have lectured some of them in UL.
Okay.
And it was tricky being young when 50% of the squad, maybe more, were older than me.
Yeah.
So once again, steep learning curve.
What are you doing? What, like, on a day-to-day basis with them? What are you taking sessions? What was your role?
Yeah, effectively I came in initially in the physical training side of things, but that kind of morphed or transitioned into a full training stroke coaching role,
right?
Which for me is very important in terms of how you include the both into one entity. So it started off quite defined and then got quite big quite soon, and for the next 2 years that was my role, with Mickey Ned as manager, and we had a couple of selectors as well.
Okay, so you were taking all the sessions, planning those.
Yeah.
And how does that dovetail with what the manager at that stage of your career, and I guess it evolves depending on what managers you're working with, but they're like, okay, so our style of play has to be, these are our strengths, the training sessions need to be tailored accordingly. How do those conversations evolve, and what's your involvement with those?
I think it actually helps in many respects if you have a strength conditioning coach who has a background in the sport itself, or vice versa, a coach who has an understanding of strength conditioning and physical preparation, because if the two don't work in alignment, you know, very often you're going to have a fracture, not just in a session, but across a period of time, you know, across a league campaign, building up for championships. So, I mean, if everyone is on the same page and there's a mutual trust, honesty, understanding, and that goes right up to the manager as well. I think at least you're setting yourself up in, you know, in a solid environment to really succeed. But when people work in their individual silos, if you like, very often the players aren't getting the full benefit.
Yeah.
They might be getting the individual blocks of performance, but they're not actually knitting or meshing into each other to make them the best athlete they can be, and that's when things go wrong.
Yeah, and ultimately that's kind of pointless, because the great teams and your competitors aren't doing that. They've got a proper system where everything is aiming towards an overwhelming conclusion. Christy, when did you start getting involved as a coach?
First, it was 2005 actually. Jerome was brought in by Galway. Connor Hayes would have worked as a goalkeeping coach that year. The following year I did goalkeeping work, and I worked as a statistician with them as well. They would have done a small bit with Clare towards the end of the decade, and then Dalo brought me in with Dublin when he moved in 2009. Would have on and off with Dalo for 6 years, and did some stuff with John Allen, and brought me in Limerick in 2012, and been with Limerick since. And then the last few years I've worked with Limerick and Galway, so I suppose I've been lucky that, you know, worked with good people, good teams, great keepers. And I've been lucky and fortunate that, you know, I've been allowed to work with, you know, two teams in the one season. And I know that can be tricky, but I just work specifically with the keepers. I have no involvement in management teams. Don't write about those teams I'm involved in. So yeah, it's been grand. It's great. Like, I suppose, look, you're working in a high performance environment, you know, challenging. You're trying to, I suppose, make guys better. And you're trying to evolve and learn the whole time. And I suppose, look, I wouldn't be coming from a sports science background like Keane, but, you know, you do try and upskill yourself. I would have studied a lot of stuff like plyometrics, you know, feet work, stuff like that, that, you know, you're trying to... I would have played a lot of soccer when I was younger as well, and I would have got a good grounding in goalkeeping coaching from that soccer background. Obviously, completely different sports, but...
So you had a goalkeeping coach when you were playing?
No, I didn't, but I would have learned a lot just from basic stuff, even like communication. I learned so much from soccer that, you know, like, you know, communication is massive in terms of offside. And it was one thing that I really brought into my hurling career, you know, was that communication, that often, you know, some of the best keepers are the best communicators, that, you know, they, maybe they don't have to make the saves because they have their defences properly set up.
Yeah.
And that was one thing I learned from soccer, that, you know, they said, oh, you're too quiet, we can't hear you. And, you know, I think that there's a lot of good keepers out there that are not the best communicators, and they're maybe not the best keepers. So,
were you a goalkeeper in soccer as well?
I was, actually, yeah, yeah.
Well, that's a bit weird, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's funny.
You've got a thing about goalkeeping.
The funny thing about the soccer thing is it was completely by chance, because I would have played in goals for Flannans for a couple of years, and in my last year, I was 7 days overage for the Harty. So a few of the lads in my class, there were guys that had been good friends with in school in the boys' national Ennis, they were big soccer guys, and they said, come on, go off playing soccer for the year. So instead of studying for the leaving, I kind of I decided I'd play a bit of soccer as well. So, you know, we got to Munster Youth semi-final, we won the league that year with Avenue United. We had some great wins. Remember, we went down to Waterford, beat I think it was the South End United. I think there are two or three internationals, a couple of under 15 internationals. We beat Killarney Celtic in a great game out in Quinn. It was a brilliant experience. Like, the one thing I used to love about the soccer was, this is a long time ago, but I couldn't get my head around the different mentalities, whereas even back then, I suppose hurling was so serious. And whereas, you know, we used to have this coach, Eddie Ryan, God be good to him, he was a brilliant fella. And we used to have these team talks in O'Keefe's bar the night before the games, and Eddie's team talk basically was, lads, I'm going round the nightclub now later on, and if I see any inside it, you're dropped for tomorrow. Like, I just couldn't get my head around this. But it was brilliant. It was relaxed. It was serious. It was relaxed. But I actually learned a lot from it, and I took a lot with it. And that's what coaching's really all about, Ger. It's evolving and developing and trying to, I suppose ultimately the guys you coach, they represent you in a kind of a discreet way, but, you know, you try and do the best for them, because that's what you're ultimately there for. It's not about...
Talk to us about what sessions are like. So you're exclusively a goalkeeping coach?
Exclusively goalkeeping, yeah.
And
well, I've done coaching, obviously I've done a lot in the club, and
yeah,
I've done other stuff, and I maybe down the line I'd like to branch into that, because I'm very interested. But look, it's goalkeeping coach, you can make it sound like as scientific or as, you know, space age as you want, but it's really about, I suppose, focusing on basics. You know, a lot of stuff like angle work, like the whole goalkeeping culture has dramatically changed. Now, if you look at the way, for example, like you look at the goals that Tipperary scored this year in the Championship, like on average last year, every goal Kilkenny scored, it was on average 7 yards out. This year, I'd say you're talking about the same. So really, like, you know, you see goalkeeping coaches taking shots from 21 yards or 21 metres, or like, why do you do that? That's not what happens in a match. It's a lot of the goalkeeping philosophy I have is, it's, you know, fast hands, fast feet. You know, it's often the second shot as opposed to the first shot. It's the most important, getting off your line, playing your angles, shutting down danger, getting your body in front of the ball. And to be honest with you, a lot of it has been redefined, I would feel, by Brendan Cummins, because he completely altered how goalkeepers should play. And,
yeah,
you know, he was an unbelievable keeper. Now, obviously, you've had some unbelievable keepers over the last decade, but Cummins, I think, really redefined the whole sport. And I think I would probably have looked at Cummins closer than anyone else. And, you know, just a lot of stuff about averting danger as opposed to maybe, you know, making, you know, brilliant saves.
And what about puckouts? Like, do you work?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Massive. Because, you know, you even talk to keepers that sometimes they come to you and you ask them, how often do you practice your puckouts? And they'd say, not really. And you say, well, what are you guaranteed to do in a match? Like, you're guaranteed to hit 30 puckouts.
Yeah.
you might get one save if you're lucky. You might get two balls to catch. So strike can obviously be a massive part of the coaching philosophy. It has to be, because the goalkeeper now really is like the quarterback.
Yeah, and like, are you involved in the discussion of the puck out strategy then as well?
Yeah, that's my only really involvement with management.
Okay.
And you know, but I do think that has to be involved. That has to involve the rest of the team as well.
Yeah, of course.
No point doing it with just the goalies, because a lot of it too, Jerry, I think a lot of it is, as well. It's like, you know, you look at the American football analogy. How do these guys, you know, get away from cornerbacks or it's separation. It's they decide where the quarterback throws the ball. It's like the same in hurling of football. It's like, you know, you look at Cluxon, he's the best kicker in the game, but he's obviously, if you look at any camera from behind the goals, he's got three or four guys moving. He's got options. You might need four guys to move for it to be on once. And it's really about, it's not about hitting the guy, it's about hitting the space and what happens after that. So it's and that's a massive development in GAA in the last 5 years.
Yeah, I suspect it's probably the most interesting part of the job as well. Kieran, to come to you on this, you obviously were and still are a journalist and a writer, but at some point you decided that you wanted a bit more from life.
I suppose before I was writing, although I was always wanting to be a journalist since I was 7 or 8, but in a previous lifetime, Christy's talking about a previous lifetime as a soccer goalkeeper, as well as I know him, I didn't know that. I was a basketball coach from when I was 18, 20, so I was always, like Keane actually at a similar age would have been big into basketball as well. So I came across sports psychology even at, you know, 18, 19, 20. So I was always interested in the field. And then, as you say, I became a sports writer as a career. And I was, Waterford were starting a master's, the first full-time master's in the country, and in 2005, 2006. So I signed up for it because I thought it would help my writing. You know, the way that people who do financial journalism have studied finance. And we're here, we do journalism, but have we actually any qualification to fall back on? So I thought it would help my sports writing rather than to go in to do what I would. But actually, so what happened, and it's Gas that he's actually here, we had to do a placement in the course. So my first ever dressing room I was in was the Dura Bearfield dressing room.
All right.
So Christy's a contact. I worked with the Dura Bearfield lads, and it was an education beyond education, which has served me well. So that's how I started it. So learned from it, did the masters. We started doing work with individual clients. So the first intercounty, because I was the gag car of the Sunday Tribune at the time. So it wouldn't be something you would really take on in that role. But a special dispensation was allowed by my sports editor at the time when Malachy O'Rourke had just got the Fermanagh job.
Right.
And he was aware that my father was a Fermanagh man, and he felt that for what was needed, we needed just someone who was more than a sports psych. So met Malachy, we clicked. And that year was the year, if you remember, went through, got promoted, unbeaten, and got to the county's only third ever time in an Ulster final. And that was a special experience. And so that was my first time working with Intercounty.
What are you doing with them? Like, and did you know what you would be doing? So you start with St. Joseph's Dura Bearfield and then you kind of graduate, but you kind of realise pretty quickly what the role has to be? Or is it?
Yeah, but it changed from that. I learned from the Fermanagh. I like to think I really hit it off with those boys, but the model was limited, and I learned to go to another level and work with other teams since that the model had to change, as in just even geographically. I was living in Clare, the lads were up in Fermanagh.
A bit far.
So the way it would typically work would have been a lot of workshops with the group. You know, we started in January. I remember the first time meeting the boys in an hotel in Kildare. Keane, I think it was where you were married, man. That's where I met them for the first time. And a couple of weeks out from the league. So I've done regular workshops with the group, and I was available for one-to-ones when I was, they could call me on the phone. I was regularly on to management, you know, but I wasn't at many of their games. And I learned from that. So the next time I roll out the model at Intercounty, to do one-to-ones way more regularly. And that when I look at it, like, I mean, that team were, we lost by one more point would have done us the Ulster final. And I learned from that to be available for more one-to-ones. There was one or two boys, even between the draw and a replay, that I would love to have got to. But it learned an awful lot of from, you could tell like Maliki was going to be like he's one of the best managers of the last 10 years.
Yeah, yeah.
And we learned an awful lot from each other. We worked really well, and that was I sometimes forget about it, but no, it was a special experience.
And not to ask for specifics about that team or anybody really, like when you're working on a one-to-one basis, is it about psychological training, or because it seems like it might be a bit of counselling in many instances?
Yeah, well, sometimes you're meeting guys in different circumstances like that, but I suppose my training would be more on the, like I did a sports psychology master's rather than doing a psychology training. I came a different pathway, but so a lot of it, although, you know, just as a human being, you'd be clicking with where a guy is at that point. But like Cian touched on it there about it's the collaboration, and that it helps that, like it has helped me working as, sometimes managers, when they're introducing me, because guys might have had, you're going into an inter-county dressing room, they've seen all types, and yeah, it maybe hasn't hit off. But I think what does help is like, they nearly call me a GA psychologist running a sports psychologist, because I know I'm just so immersed in the sport. But one of the ways that you're working with is collaborating with, let's say, a typical function of sports psychology, and it's even in the Paul O'Connell book, is, let's say, goal setting. Well, in goal setting, that's you're dealing multidisciplinary there. So like it could be, you're linking in with, like I work with Keane in 2012 at Mayo. You know, you might be linking in on something on the skills side. You might be linking on something on with the nutritionist, the S&C coach. So it's very specific.
It's a granular level of detail when you're goal setting, as opposed to we're going to win Sam. It's like, okay, so
The buzzword, and we brought it into Mayo, and they use the term a lot, and Dublin always talk about that process. I mean, like that's a controllable. That is how you get towards outcomes, you know. So like even Paul O'Connell admitted in his book, like a lot of his goal setting were kind of bullshit goals, because they were just win the Heineken Cup. You know, then you have to get specific into it. And how do you do that? You do that by getting better. Like one of our mentors would have been, the better you get, the better it gets. So, right, how do we do that? So you're sounding board a lot for the players. I've worked with guys from other counties who might have had a bad experience. And you're actually a sounding board. You get them actually to come up with a lot of the solutions. But it does help to have a training in the discipline itself, sports psychology.
So, Cian, obviously, you progressed from Limerick and then end up with Kerry and end up with...
You're skipping tip there. You know, like that was a big one.
Good 4 years there.
Yeah, with Eamon O'Shea and...
Liam. Came in with Liam that time, and Eamon and Mick, and stayed on for a year when Liam stepped down.
Okay.
For anything, just to support the transition, because it was a significant transition after 3 big years, you know. League title and 2 All-Irelands. You won, we were very disappointing not to win, and then to win it the next year. So. Yeah. And of course, it was a shock when Liam stepped down as well, let's be honest, you know, because nobody wanted that to happen. But obviously, Liam had his own reasons, work and family, you know.
Yeah.
So the reason I stayed on really was for that transition, and they were just a fantastic group of players. Loved my time there and didn't want to let it go, effectively.
Yeah. What are you doing for them?
My specific role there was the physical conditioning and the athletic preparation. But I guess coming from a football background, the tackle, as much as it's not defined in Gaelic football, it's not even closely defined in hurling. So I was able to bring a lot of that coaching knowledge and experience into hurling, and just try and work in that aspect of their game. Tip very often would have been accused of having a soft core, for want of a better term. I'd say there was many reasons why they weren't successful for that period in the noughties, but that's one thing that we really wanted to bring into the setup, and not just in Eamon's hurling and Liam's management, but also in everything we were doing in our game-based training.
Can you talk to us about the specifics, how that might actually work? Is it like, is there a drill that you have to kind of get that going and say the reason we're doing this is because, is that how that works?
Yeah, very much game-based. I mean, one of the big faults I would see with a lot of physical training in sport of all different codes, and I see it with my students, you know, in UL and in CIT now, is that they do everything in isolation, away from the game. So they're working in isolated sprints, or working on isolated aerobic training. Never have a hurl in their hand, never have a football in their hand, never kicking, passing. And one of the key things any player will tell you is, you know, when the challenge really comes on them in a match, is executing the fundamental skills when they're tired. So why separate the two as such? And that's one thing that I would have brought into tip, and it made a lot of sense to them, it made a lot of sense to me, and I'd like to think they benefited from it, you know, but ultimately it had to come back to their hurling and to the game, and that's one thing that we were very sure about.
Just to double back on ourselves, you were a PE teacher. At what point do you upskill from being a PE teacher, and how did you do that?
I suppose, like Kieran wanted to be a journalist since he was 7 or 8, I was always interested in coaching. You know, my dad was heavily involved in community games in Kildare growing up, Peter. And I just grew up like going to a drafts competition, going to a football match, going to a basketball match. So I always wanted to be immersed in sport, even if I didn't get PE teaching, you know, in the glory of CEO. I still would have went and done another coaching course or teaching course. And it was all about learning, you know, reading, going to other training sessions. Munster, based in UL, was very useful for anyone. I was shocked by the low level of people who were actually watching their training sessions, because for me, anyone within a 20-mile radius of Limerick should have been down there looking at what was happening, and they weren't.
And were you still a PE teacher at that point, or you must do a master's and your PhD somewhere along the way?
I thought for a year, I came out of UL in 2000 and went straight into a PhD then, and that's when the whole sports science thing started clicking with me.
And what was that PhD in, as a matter of interest?
It was actually about measurement and the validation of measurement and how to measure effectively, focusing on different physical measures.
Okay, so you did that with the express intention of, I'm going to work in sport.
Yeah, absolutely. I like the thought of lecturing. You know, that teacher was always in me. And for me, there's not a significant difference behind the framework or the concepts of coaching or teaching.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of it comes down to the same thing, you know. So I always knew it was there. And when the opportunities arose, I just grabbed them. But as Kieran said, you're continuously learning. One thing I would have said about Kieran's work with Mayo was the reason he was so successful in the 1 year I was there, because everything was grounded in reality. You know, having worked with a lot of sports psychs or performance coaches or, you know, people that thought they were over the years, very often they talked in language that didn't impress on the players. The players didn't understand that they couldn't draw a relationship with what their game was all about.
Yeah.
Kieran used real world examples and kind of get them thinking about their own game as opposed to the theory of psychology, which is a huge mistake because that's not what players want.
Yeah, so it's jargon and that kind of...
But it makes them feel
better. Barrier, yeah.
You know, it's almost like they're showing how much they know, where it really should be about what could this do for the players.
Yeah. So when you're at TIP, at some point are you thinking, I want to be a manager, or are you still thinking, actually, this is fine because it's a nice balance between my career needs to be continually progressing while at the same time I am involved in elite level sport?
Yeah, you know, I always wanted to be involved in elite level sport. I always wanted to work with athletes. You know, that's something that I was very sure about. I think this notion of always wanted to be a manager or always wanted to be the Kildare manager, I think that's a soundbite and it probably reads well. You know, I was involved with the Sigerson and UL for 6 years, Fitzgibbon for 5 or 6 years, with Richard Cunningham, and I was delighted doing that while I was working with counties. So it wasn't about one job.
Yeah.
It was just about working with great guys, great athletes, male or female. But when the opportunity arose, the reason I left TIP effectively was football was my game.
Yeah.
You know, and I wanted to get back into football and was fortunate to have an opportunity to work with Mayo. But even then with Kerry, it wasn't about, I'm going to leave Kerry to manage a team. It was, when my time is up with Kerry, I'd like to stay involved, whatever that post may be. You know?
And so it was a handy coincidence that the Kildare job was available.
Like a happy
coincidence, yeah.
It literally was, absolutely, because...
would have been happy to be involved with another inter-county team if that job hadn't come up, maybe.
Well, I would like to think that if that job didn't come up and if it wasn't Kildare, you know, I would have been in Kerry the next year.
Yeah.
Like, there was no other reason I would have left working with Eamon and the boys, you know, because it was a fantastic experience.
So it wasn't that you had the time now to become a manager?
No, no. And it wasn't that burning desire. It's just because it was home. And that was the only reason. If it was any other job, I wouldn't have even contemplated leaving the great setup we had in Kerry.
Yeah, because Cork to Kildare a couple of times a week isn't easy.
No, it's not. It's not. A lot of it comes down to time management and, you know, my work, you know, the management at CIT, they're very supportive of what we do. It's a very student-centred but sports-centred third-level institution. So, you know, I work hard, I work long hours to afford me maybe leaving an hour earlier to get through the tunnel, which is the biggest killer with the travel. And obviously the fact that I'm from Newbridge and my wife Tammy is from Newbridge means that it's not a problem staying up there for 3 or 4 days because we have family friends around us as well, you know.
Okay. A couple of quick texts here before we move on to the next bit. Colm says, would the panel advise to start with coaching courses before getting into dressing rooms? Was it straight enough for you? Did Fermanagh accept you? Did St. Joseph's accept you straight away? Or was there a bit of, hang on a second now? No. This guy's actually a journalist.
Yeah. Well, that didn't really come into it. Like, it was... it definitely, like, you have to have... You're talking about having a coach insert to...
Well, just the sense of being accepted in a dressing room. And because you're not a coach, so you probably don't need one in your instance. But
yeah, well, it goes back to what Keane said. I mean, particularly when it comes to sports, like, people are wondering, well, what's this? So you have to be really real with them. But it does help to have the theory. You just... like I would often say, quote, you know, let's say sometimes when I work with JA teams, you're dealing with a hurling team, you might quote somebody in football. You know, so you might, let's say, quote Peter Canavan, but know your banjura or your the theory, but you don't quote the theory. You know, that's one of the, and like maybe I learned that in Dura Bearfield. Maybe I got on grand with the lads, but I'd say I was a different level 2 years later because I.
He was terrible. You can spill the beans now, Christy.
Ask him actually about he did a study on, I think, the remote language that was used in addressing him before a game in Scarf.
The first day, I think I spoke about this with Joe, but he said where it was. But you're talking about an education addressing room, and the first game we had, right? We're playing Scarf up above. We scored the first 3 points of the game, all good. They had a little run. They went a goal and two or whatever. But anyway, we scored the last 3 points, had the wind, had gone a point up. Right? We had Big Mo, as Jack O'Connor would say. And one of the things I had to do was do observation, right? And the language. And I remember just we lost the game. And I sat down with the selectors a few days later and said to one of the first selectors, I said to him, how many times do you think you use the word lads? And he said, I don't know. And I said, 12. I said, right, how many times do you think you use the F word? Jesus, I don't know. I said, 14 times. And then I went to the manager, who you know, and it ended up being, he used it 37 times. And it just becomes, you know, it loses its effect. And like we misused a lot of energy that day, but it was an absolute education, and we learned from that. And at halftime, and definitely through the years, you can do your sports, like you can do your PhDs, but if you don't have a placement and you're not, you're, like I learned a lot in Scariff, and I learned a lot down in Dura Bearfield, going back to the course. But it helps to have a qualification. You can't just go in and not have something to you. You have to have an expertise, but it goes back to then finding your own way to communicate it, because it is about the athletes. It can be self-defeating if you're trying to help a player's confidence and their mental game and all of it. You've got to break down a certain barrier then to enhance it. So that's how I often do it, and it's just building a rapport with them. And I suppose with Fermanagh, it really helped that. Like one of the first things I did, I told him about my story. I told him about my father. And how I mentioned about how I wasn't at their games. It was an unusual one, but I said I won't be with you on Ulster final day because I'm bringing my father to the Ulster final. So to create a routine, I wasn't going to be at the first round when we beat Monaghan, the second round against Derry, who'd won the league. I was going to be with my father, and a lot of them were, I can't wait to meet your father. And that became kind of, you know, everybody identified who their father was. So there was that element, but I mean, it was very practical too, and the steps we had to take.
I'd be a lot stronger on that point from my perspective, obviously, because I come from a coaching background, yeah, in terms of the PE, the sports science. And I feel that GA are light years behind some of the top sporting organisations, similar to the GA, like the FEI, the IRFU, in terms of who can actually just walk into a setup and become a coach and become a manager.
Yeah.
I'm not saying you have to have all your coaching badges to be a great coach or to be a great manager, but, and it helps if you come from a background like teaching, where you're a good communicator, you know how to plan, you know how to do, you know how to review, all of these important things. But I do get worried when I see people walking into jobs with no background in the area, but they've probably played a bit, and maybe they're exceptional players, and that seems to be the validity of their ability as a coach.
Yeah.
I mean, it certainly wouldn't happen. You look at the Premier League and you look at the professional footballers earning millions training under 14s in their club, but they have to because they're striving for the UEFA B license. And similar with the IRFU, you know, and that is a worry for me, because you have guys out there who are studying and they're on coaching courses and they're not getting an opportunity, even though they're trying to get their own ducks in a row to be a top coach, because the system is almost validating people who, you know, who've played the game, who are in the system already.
It's a very old school way of looking at things.
It is. And as I said, you don't need, you know, to be a GA level 3 coach to be a phenomenal coach. But I do think that everyone should have a minimum standard. And at least then they can decide, is this the pathway I want to embark on? Do I want to learn more or not?
Yeah.
You know, and I find even at the GA coaching conference, I'm coaching for many, many years now, and I would still never miss that conference, because I might pick up one thing that could make me a better coach or manager. And I'm shocked every year by the amount of people I don't know, but that I should know, such as people working with counties, development squads, people from my own county. And I'm saying, where are these guys? I mean, this is organised once a year for coaches. And is it because they think they know it all? Or more worryingly for me, is it that they actually don't know what they don't know?
Yeah.
And that they're the most scary people for me. I think in the GA coaching culture, we need to be a little bit more open and acceptable about learning from each other and learning more.
Yeah. The difficulty seems to be that the whole GAA coach thing is like, it's not, you can't really talk about it because, well, so many managers are being paid at club level per session, all that kind of, and it's not, it hasn't been dealt with. Mm. Like, if that was dealt with in a way that, okay, this is all up and above board, and to qualify to be one of these people who can get paid for these roles where we all know every club in the country is paying people, then you need the following qualifications. But because I think it's all, nodding a wink here, lads, I think that definitely feeds into that.
Yeah, but it's a different point, I think, like where there's guys who aren't getting paid who are from a certain county that might be coaching their own county. And it is true, sure, to say, where are they? Like, it is, we talk about a lot, it's term we all use now, the growth mindset. And like, one thing that struck me about Keane actually in his time with Mayo, I remember like Mick Dempsey and yourself were going head to head for Liam McCarthy for the previous 4 years, you know, with Tip and Kilkenny. But I remember actually in our build up to the Dublin semi-final in 2012, Mick actually sat in at some of our sessions, yeah, on Keane's invite. Now, you like that, they had a relationship to do that. It was like, there's nothing to hide here, you know, there. And he wanted to see Keane in operation in a football field. They learn from each other. Whereas often in GAA, we can be very protective of, geez, don't be showing that to that crow, because 2 years' time, that might come against us when we're playing.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think that applies to the naming of teams as well, by the way. But, like, you know, the teams are named. Like, I think I agree with you. Everybody protects this thing thinking that you've got some competitive advantage, when the truth is there is no competitive advantage until the ball gets thrown in and the referee blows the whistle and away we go. I think that there's far too much protectionism and stuff.
Well, like, you take in the other sports, like we come from a basketball background, and you'd have the top, like, that was one thing, that's the background I came from. You'd have coaches, you know, sitting down, rival coaches even sitting down going through salt and pepper about their moves. There's that kind of culture rather than protecting it. The other, but yet they won't give you their matchups, which I could understand maybe why some people are a little bit guarded about. Mm. Given their, like, you talk about the soccer, is it only 90 minutes beforehand they give it in? So that's a slightly separate one, I would say.
Yeah,
the irony is, what a well-known fact in New Zealand rugby, who are obviously the foremost authority and the top team in the world at the moment, it's a well-known fact that the culture of coaching there is that we share everything, you know, from the different provinces, the different regions, right up to the senior squad. And there's a lovely chapter in James Kerr's book, Legacy, about that, and how they feel it's important that they're passing on all this knowledge to each other, as opposed to keeping it away from each other, because it's feeding into the national greatness, if you like, and yeah, to the underage structure as well.
But I do think, though, Ger, that the culture is changing. And a lot of it is probably inspired by, you know, third level education. And, like, you know, in the past, especially at club level, you know, you'd basically recruit a coach or get a coach because he's a bag of county medals or he's a few All-Ireland medals. Whereas now, like, you know, like, people would have come to me in the past, you know, because there's this mad scramble every year. Everybody wants to get a coach. You know, it's a case of supply and demand. You know, who's out there, who's available, don't even check his qualifications. And I would have said to lads, look, why don't you maybe go to UL or ask somebody in UL, you know, some young fellow who's coming out who maybe might have played, mightn't have been a big name.
Or CIT, Christy.
Yeah, or CIT, exactly. Well, I'm speaking from like an N or Dur Barefield perspective, you know, or LIT. You know, some young fellow who's you know, tuned in, who's well-educated, who's hungry, who, you know, wants to get on the circuit, wants to get on the ladder, you know, is mad keen. He knows his stuff. He knows all about taper, and he knows all about, you know, freshness, all of that stuff, as opposed to just getting a guy because he's a name and he hasn't, he maybe doesn't really understand the players. Maybe he's a different generation. And, you know, that whole process, because I do think that, you know, a lot of the professional culture, and I suppose modern GA inter-county scene has been probably promoted from the college scene, because, you know, you've had a lot of strikes maybe in the last 10-15 years, and I think a lot of that stuff came from, you know, guys are working at Fitzgibbon, Sigerson level, you know, high performance culture, doing everything, you know, absolutely to the T. And then they're going back to maybe their inter-county team and they're saying, geez, hold on a second, this doesn't really add up, we're not as professional. And, you know, players know that they're independent, they're strong-minded, they're saying, hold on a second, now we're not going to accept this. And, you know, I think we can learn a lot from the third level. And I know people might say, oh, well, hold on a second, what do some of these guys, you know, how many medals have they won? I don't think it's really about that. I think it's about the players want to be coached properly. They want to be educated properly. They don't want a guy with a big name who's going to shout and roar and tell you all what he did. Like, yeah. So I do think that, you know, there is a balance there whereby you have your hurling coach, you have your S&C coach, you maybe have a coach who is still learning about the game, but he looks at things differently. He looks at maybe the sport in a different manner because he's from a different background. And, you know, there's always something to be gained from that. So I do think, Ger, that the culture is changing, but I suppose it goes back to my point at the start. It's a case of supply and demand. Everyone is mad keen for an outside coach because they want a different perspective. And often it's a case of who's available as opposed to who's the best qualified or who is the best qualified for that particular team.
Yeah. All right, just to tell everybody, Olivier Giroud has scored twice to put Arsenal 3-1 up against Sunderland. Jermaine Defoe had equalised, but then two quick goals from Giroud has given Arsenal a 3-1 lead with 15 minutes left to go on that one. One of the other things in Legacy that I always found very interesting was how the coaches hand the power over to the captains of the team as the game progresses. It's obviously much easier in a full-time professional environment to do that because you're watching them, making sure that they're managing the whole thing. As a manager, is that something you're trying to do with players and make sure that, I mean, obviously everybody wants the players to have ownership, but there's practicalities involved in that, and particularly when you've got a team that's developing like your team is at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. I think culture is, the difficulty with culture is it's immeasurable. You know, it's not something tangible, like a fitness test or like the score in a match or a tackle count or whatever. So I think it's one of the most important aspects in management and in coaching that you can develop. Instill number one coming from you, and then develop a culture where it is player driven and player centred, and the environment has to be right there. I guess the biggest challenge for me last year, and then maybe looking back would I have done it differently, is that I just felt that everybody deserves an opportunity going in. So we were looking at 46 to 48 players, you know, up until Christmas, cut it down, and then another probably 40 players in the Auburn Cup. So by the time the league started, you know, I just had confidence in the group that we would succeed in Division 3. But what we lacked at that stage was a really tight cohesion within the group because it had been so broad and so vast up to that point. So it was difficult at that stage to develop a culture when you have matches happening every week. And when I sat down with Rowley and Enda, the new management team this year, one of the first things we wanted to start from day one was to develop and instilling this culture. We've 10 under 21s in the squad this year. Very, very young group. And they're actually very malleable. You know, it's very easy to work with young players like that, as opposed to having a lot of older players who aren't necessarily senior, but they might be older, who have come through two or three different regimes. And they're not sure the identity either of themselves or their role within the squad. So it's something that we're putting a huge emphasis on this year. And in a very short period, because we're only meeting back around now, the response is very positive. But because it's immeasurable, you know, it's very difficult really to put your finger on how well we're progressing at that level. Time will tell.
Yeah. How do you start that? What are the conversations about? Is it just saying this is something that's very important, these are our values? Is it as simple as that?
That's exactly it. And that's actually what happened last Sunday, believe it or not, only 6 days ago, when we met the group. It was about just discussing what our philosophy is going to be for the year, and what our value system is. And Lee Moggan, our performance coach, facilitated that session brilliantly, insofar as that instead of having a room, you know, of 30, 35 guys sitting down and people looking at each other, are they going to speak? You know, just to be able to break them into small groups, to give everyone a voice, give them their flip chart, and then report back to the group. Even that reporting back instilled a level of confidence, especially in the younger guys, that their voice was being heard. And across that group, I think of everyone there, 95% of people spoke openly. There'll always be one or two people that don't feel comfortable. But to actually get that on paper and to enable me and the two boys to sit down, package it, and to send it out to them in their words, it's quite an empowering thing, you know. So that was a good starting point for us.
Because that's obviously about the approach to doing the job, and then there's the specifics about how you want the team to play, mm-hmm. and what that is and what that philosophy is, and they're two different things. Obviously, if you get the first one, the culture, right, the second one you can play around, and that can be malleable too as the season progresses. unless you have a very specific, I want my team to play this way, and I always think the team should play this way.
Yeah, and I think that's very naive in Gaelic games because we don't have a transfer system. So even if we have this great idea and philosophy about how the game should be played, unless you have the players in terms of, you know, their skill level, their physical attributes, you know, the demographic of the squad, unless you have that at your disposal, it's very hard to actually, you know, to enforce, you know, some type of tactical ploy on them. For me, you need to cut your cloth and your tactics should be developed relative to the players you have. If the transfer system was there, you could bring these guys in, you know, to fit that role, but it's not. So I kind of always smirk to myself when I hear, you know, pundits, or obviously not Christy and Kieran here, but journalists who question what managers are doing tactically, when really the only people who know why they're doing what they're doing are the people within the four walls of that dressing room, and that's the management team. And it may look strange, bizarre, unusual from the outside, but there's obviously a good reason. They're training 3 to 5 days a week for 9-10 months of the year, you know.
Yeah, I wish that everybody would talk about it a bit more openly. That's the thing. Like, so if there are those questions, the manager should come out and say, well, we went this way because we figured that it was going to win us the game. There's still not quite that culture from management either. Yeah. A couple of quick texts on this. How can young coaches learn from county teams when most of the training takes place behind closed doors? The culture isn't changing. 3 county teams turned down my request to watch sessions this year. No CPD in the GAA. Hashtag dark ages.
But it doesn't need to be county teams. I mean, some of the, like, if you were at the matches, I wasn't myself based in Cork, but the Dublin semi-finals during the week, I'd say they were both fantastic matches. Yeah. I doubt if the St. Vincent's or the, you know, the, if the Cross McGlen, you know, or the Dr. Crokes, I doubt if those training sessions are closed. So you don't need to go to county sessions to develop. You could start as, go to your school team. They might have a great school team. Go to your local club. I think sometimes there's too much an emphasis on what happens at inter-county level, when at grassroots level there's absolutely fantastic work going on.
Yeah. That whole point about culture and not really knowing how well it's going, I guess in the more evolved teams, the ones who are kind of a bit further down the line, you can sense if the culture is being self-policed by the players. And are there markers that you'd be looking for as somebody involved with a team like that?
Yeah, I mean, we were actually just talking about it in the car up. Like that process that Keane was talking about, it does help when the players come up with it. Look, what do you want it to be? As much as management, you will maybe steer them a certain way, and you will have, look, this is how we do things around here. It comes down to how we do things around here and taking pride in that. And it's not, like, a good measure for me is, I saw Clive Woodward was on, that's where I kind of picked it up first, was he talked about Lombardy time. In other words, you've to be at meetings early. Like, I remember hearing back from some of the Mayo lads that I would have worked with under James Horne's time, when they went to the international rules, 3 or 4 of them would be early for the team meeting, and guys would say, gee, the Mayo lads are very clickish. They weren't. They were used to Lombardy time. They were used to being on time. They just happened to be, they maybe went from 4 separate rooms, but they were the first 4 guys there, because we had a thing that, like, if you're a measure of a slip up might be if the bus leaves at the wrong time, you know, 2 guys late. That is where games are won and lost. That's culture. Like, we just have David Moyes in the background, and I sometimes think in the Premiership, there's a guy who's going in August. What chance? What time do you get to do a culture? Because and one interesting thing about the GAA is that you have the games coming in the league. Like, I imagine Keane going in first year, that was harder to do. But that's just one measure. There's loads of little things, and a lot of the sessions I would facilitate a bit, like Liam did with that last week with the Kildare boys, is, lads, how do we do things around here? And you might give a couple of suggestions, and that gets their imagination going, and we have a great discussion about it. And look, are we sure we want to do that like that? Because you touched on it, identity is how we play. Identity is how we just do everything, and that is. The confidence and the commitment that comes from that is huge. And as you say, that's what the top teams have.
Yeah. When you're trusted by a manager to be part of the backroom team, how free do you feel to say things, to point things out? Like, what level of engagement? You have to be fully engaged, obviously, and so I accept that. But at the same time, the manager has to place a huge amount of trust in you. So those one-on-one conversations, you're saying something and then the manager comes in and goes, "Ah," and you're like, oh, that's not exactly what
Yeah, like a lot of it is, and a lot of the way I roll things out, and there would be some models I'd roll out, particularly at club level, where the players don't see me and it's just with the manager. But an awful lot of it is, and one of the themes we're touching on here is coaching the coaches, because ultimately the coaches have to be the sports psychologists as well. I mean, you can, in sports psychology we talk about self-talk, etc., but if the management then are doing something different completely, yeah, that undermines it, and you know, and it needs to be all of the management, not just the manager, you know, your selectors have to be at that, and that they are doing best practice. You know, what you're trying to create is a psychologically informed environment. And what you do find is you create a language within the group. So let's say in Mayo that James Horan would have been reiterating a lot of the messages that I would have been using. I'd have been reiterating a lot of his. You know, we would have worked with people like Keane, with Ed Collin. You create a language within the group. So you've to be, when you work with managers, you know, you're going to discuss things, you're going to brainstorm, you're going to have sometimes, you're going to have a little bit of storming, and then you might have the norming and the performing. So you have to have that environment where you have to speak openly with each other.
Yeah. The sense that what's coming next in your career, Christy, it seems like you do want to be a coach, like and have full responsibility for the coaching side of things. Is that completely different from at some point wanting to be a manager?
Yeah, I think, look, as Keane said, you probably don't set out to be a manager. You don't set out to be, you know, I never set out to be a goalkeeping coach per se. It was just something I always, you know, liked to do. And, you know, when I look back on my career, you know, I didn't probably have anybody to point out stuff to me. And I often go back to, you know, a game we played in 2004 against Kilmaley, and I conceded this goal. I wouldn't have been blamed for it, but when I look back on it afterwards, I said, what was I doing there? Like, I just never played my angles. I just stayed on my line. And, you know, maybe if I hit somebody who could have pointed that out to me at the time, I could have maybe been hopefully would have been a better keeper. So it's just, I suppose that's what it is. It's just trying to develop and trying to educate yourself. And look, you should be always learning. You should be always trying to upscale in terms of moving to the next level. I suppose, you know, Keane made a good point there about, you know, you don't have to, it's not all at intercounty level. You see some of the setups at colleges level, even like, you know, you'd see under 16 minor management's like, you know, completely professional, because they're, you know, they're following best practice, they're upskilling themselves. You know, some of these guys are as far ahead as intercounty coaches or managers. And I suppose, you know, a lot of these guys have to start somewhere, and the sad thing about a lot of those fellas is they don't get on the ladder, they don't move up the ladder, because maybe they're not politically aligned with the county board, or they're, yeah, not, maybe they haven't played in their county. And, you know, I think some of the best coaches or some of the best minds are fellas who are just hungry, and they just really want to learn, and they want to, you know, I suppose they study all aspects of coaching, and they try and cover, you know, I remember actually doing a diploma in sports psychology about 20 years ago. I don't really, it was through Kilroy's College, I'd forgotten everything about it, but it was at the time I felt as a player mentally I wasn't the most confident player. I wasn't, you know, goalkeeping is a kind of a unique position. It's a complete mental game. I felt it was one of the parts of my game that held me back a bit, and I was just trying to upskill myself. And I just felt that, look, if I can do anything to help myself become a better keeper, I'll do it. And it's the same in coaching. Like, you're always learning. Like, you know, really, if you think that you have this thing cracked, you're in the wrong game.
Yeah. If somebody offered you a coaching job, is that like, it seems like you love doing the one-on-one session with the goalkeepers, but actually there's all this other stuff going on about how the team should play and how the team unit should function and all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah, look, I would have 10 years ago, I spent 3 years at our minors in Dour Barefield. I spent 6 out of 7 years at our under-21s, and, you know, we didn't win anything. We were beaten in a final in 2012 by a last minute goal, and I remember at the start of that year, I was thinking of when Dalo said it in his book. You know, we played the first game we played that year was out in Corrifane, and I think we were 8 points to no score down after 15 minutes, and I was just saying, I just don't have it. Like, I haven't got it. Like, I just can't pull this off. And we came back and we won that game, and huge win. And, you know, look, that's where you cut your cloth. It doesn't always have to be, you know, where you're, like, I would have worked with Clare in the 15, 16 development squads. You know, obviously would have, you know, you're working with, I suppose even in your job, you're maybe meeting your players, and you're always talking to players, and you're trying to pick up stuff the whole time. And, like, I suppose really, it's like, to be honest, Jerry, you can, if you want to be a coach now, you know, I think you can get a job if you want one.
Yeah.
It's really, you know, what's best for you, you know, what you want out of it. You know, I've been happy to focus on goalkeeping coaching. I have worked with obviously a lot in the club. I've done some stuff with other clubs. I like it, but I suppose really with my job as well, you know, you have to kind of take, you can't completely immerse yourself in it. And if I was to immerse myself in it, I would have to dislocate myself a bit from the writing and the journalism, because, you know, you can't have it both ways. And even, yeah, you know, the counties I have worked with, you know, it's been a policy of mine that I've never written about those counties in that particular season, because, you know, I think you have to have, for people to take you seriously, you know, you're in a dressing room, I'm just going into a dressing room, I'm tugging off, I'm not really interacting as much with the players. You might go for a bit of food afterwards, but, you know, I think that they have to respect and they have to trust you as well, and that, yeah, they're not afraid that, okay, if we say something here that it's going to appear in a newspaper or appear online somewhere, and that's something I would never dream of doing, because, you know, it comes down to trust. And you talk about culture, that's part of a culture. That's not, if you're betraying that trust, that's zero professionalism and zero, yeah, proper culture.
It doesn't end very well. Kian, we started this by talking about backroom teams, and to kind of bring it full circle, your role now, obviously, as manager, you wouldn't be expected to do exactly all the things that you have done throughout your career, and yet I guess you kind of want to do them too, because that's the thing that delivered you to this point.
Yeah, absolutely. It was probably the conundrum I found myself in last year, because it was the first time, you know, that I had an added and a bigger responsibility. But and I did do a lot of the coaching, you know, last year, because it's what I do.
Yeah.
But learn from doing, you can't do it all either, you know. So probably, you know, another of several mistakes I would have made last year was that at times I probably didn't have the aerial perspective, you know, that overview, because I'm always stuck down in the middle of the players. And upon reflection, you know, and just thinking about my own performance last year and then speaking to the players, you know, sometimes maybe they're losing that individual feedback, as in individual feedback, because you're so often working with the group, you know.
Yeah.
You know, with the changes this year, Ronan Sweeney has a lot of coaching experience, Enda Murphy, so happy for Enda with Castleknock this week. I mean, Enda took them from Division 1 to Division 3, 3-1, and won an intermediate championship, and here they are in a senior final.
Is Enda coaching them, Kane, is he?
He was with them for 3 years. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's, a lot of people in Kildare wouldn't know that, because it's a Dublin team and, yeah, they were intermediate. So I mean, there's a lot of coaching experience coming in there this year, and it will allow me to step back a bit, which I would have done anyways, you know, even if last year's group is in there.
Yeah.
A lot of lessons learned there. But just to touch on something Christy said, trust is crucial, you know, in the management and the backroom setup. Just so much as trust is between players and management. And, you know, I think when you have a really tight team, you know, which has to really come from the manager down, you know, where he doesn't see himself different from the management team in the back room, and the management team, which would be the selectors, don't see themselves different from the rest of the back room. I think when that trust is there, the players see that as much as anything, and it almost encourages them to be more trusting of themselves as well as the process. Probably one of the most disappointing things in my 12 years working with inter-county teams is, you know, is hearing things a year or 2 years later from players that they never should know. You know, because someone, be it a selector or someone on the backroom team, you know, has spoken about things that were said in meetings or whatnot. You know, I think it's sacrilegious. It's sacrosanct what happens, you know, in the dressing room and in team meetings.
As a matter of interest, is this winning dressing rooms, or is it always only ever a losing dressing room?
Probably both.
Right, okay.
Probably both, yeah. You know, and sometimes maybe they don't mean it, but I think a more recent example would have been, you know, somebody extracts from Jim McGuinness's book, which was a great read, you know, but it brought a lot of attention to the things that were said about a private conversation between a manager and a coach.
Yeah.
And then Rory happened to go on to be the next manager, you know.
Yeah.
I think that type of you know, talk or breach of confidence should never happen, even when you leave a setup. You know, I think it's
almost
that important.
Especially when you leave a setup, and maybe especially when you're writing a column.
Absolutely.
Like,
absolutely.
About, yeah, the manager who's in, like, I think Rory's in a very difficult situation there, because Jim is telling everybody what happened.
Totally.
Or at least his version of it.
No, absolutely. And I mean, what happens in team meetings, in management meetings, or in private conversations on a bus to or from a match, they're really contextual. You know, they're specific to what's happening at that one moment in time, and it's not necessarily a reflection on how you feel about a player or them as a person. So when that happens after the fact, or someone who's worked with the team, then they come in with you, and I've seen this, and they start talking about another team, the first thing I say is, let's just pause right there, because that's not how, if you work with someone else,
yeah,
how I want you to be talking about our setup, you know. So I think that trust is so important, and it's probably one of the most disappointing things I've experienced in inter-county management over the years.
It's also the thing that if you get right, you kind of realise how far teams can go with just a little bit of self-belief and that kind of sense of togetherness, that ultimately if everybody's doing fairly similar levels of physical preparation, the margins aren't that big between, okay, so the very top level, the margins are huge between the top and the say the middle, but when you're kind of trying to rise a level or two, a bit of self-belief, these teams are all very similar.
Yeah, you Tipperary this year, you'd Leicester City in the Premier League last year, and you know, and I think a bit of luck along the way as well. You know, I think if you're going to meet a big hitter like a Mayo who got knocked out surprisingly in Connacht, if you're going to meet them in the back door early, I mean, that's bad luck. You know, and not just because we met them this year, but you know, Fermanagh met them before us and gave them a good rattle. I think some teams, if they can navigate their way relatively unscathed in terms of Division 1 teams, because I do think there is a gap between the top Division 1 teams and everyone else in the country, I think you've always got a chance in the qualifiers, but you do need that bit of luck to avoid those big hitters.
Yeah, alright, we've only scratched the surface here today, but my thanks to the three of you for coming in. We've been listening to Keane O'Neill, Kieran Shannon and Christy O'Connor. Great stuff, lads. Thanks a million. Arsenal have won 4-1. We'll tell you how after these.
Off the Ball with BetDak.com, the sports betting exchange. Serious about sports 24/7. Every season, every sport, every team.